Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. For many of us, storytelling feels like a childish activity, something that parents do with kids and that kids do with each other. But as we get older, we grow out of our childish fantasy world. Well, all except this guy.
Peter Pan! Oh, Peter! I knew you'd come back. I saved your shadow for you. Oh, I do hope it isn't rumpled. You know, you look exactly the way I thought you would. Oh, a little taller, perhaps, but then... You can't stick it on with soap, Peter. It needs sewing. That's the proper way to do it. Although, come to think of it, I've never thought about it before. Sewing shadows, I mean.
But in his new book, The Storytelling Animal, Jonathan Gottschall argues that humans never really grow out of storytelling. In fact, he posits, telling stories may just be a biological imperative, something that both keeps us alive and really helps us thrive. Jonathan Gottschall teaches English at Washington and Jefferson College and is the author of The Storytelling Animal. Jonathan Gottschall, thanks so much for joining us from Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So let's start with Peter Pan. And it's often, I think, used as a story whose moral is you do have to grow up and you can't keep sort of believing in fantasy all your life. But I think to you, it means something a little different. What does it mean?
I mean, there's this sort of cultural bias that stories are artifacts of culture, that they're non-biological. And there's truth in it. Stories are cultural. They influence culture. They're influenced by culture. But they're also profoundly natural. They're as natural to humans as upright posture and opposable thumbs, and just as important as those things. And so children at about 1 year of age start to learn to tell stories. They start to learn to pretend, to make believe. And at about 4 years old, they enter into the golden age of pretend play. And at about 8 years old, they start to leave that golden age of pretend play, and they spend less and less time in the land of make-believe. And the moral of the story, Peter Pan, seems to be that in order to grow up and to be an adult, a functioning, mature adult, you have to leave that world of fun and make-believe behind. But Peter Pan doesn't. And neither, I argue in the book, do we actually. We change how we do Neverland, but we never leave it behind. Instead of making up stories of our own and living inside of them, we increasingly enter into wonderlands invented by other people.
And you say that we do consume actually a fair amount of fiction. So, for example, people think of fiction as something that's on the wane, but you say that more juvenile and adult fiction is sold every year than all the categories of nonfiction combined. So what does that say about adults, their appetite for fiction? And another interesting thing, too, is that nonfiction itself feels in recent years like it's taken on a lot of the trappings of fiction, so that when you read a good sort of political story or a good biography, you almost feel like you're reading a fictional story of somebody.
Absolutely. So people from different walks of life have sort of known by instinct that if you really want people to pay attention to you, you want your message to seep in, to really embed itself in their mind, you better put it in a story. And so nonfiction writers, people like Malcolm Gladwell, people like me, have increasingly learned that if we want people to get attention, to hook them, we should use the tricks of the storytelling trade. We should use suspense. We should use characters facing problems and seeking to overcome them. So there's this worry that storytelling is on the decline, that the novel is dying, being stopped by video games or reality TV. Scripted TV is on the wane as Jersey Shore takes over. But people are really consuming more story than ever before in more different ways. So storytelling will not fade out of human life, not as long as human nature is what it is now. It may evolve, it may change how we consume our stories, but we will always be storytelling animals.
You know, I actually talked recently with Dr. Michael Rich from Children's Hospital Boston, and he studies media. And one of the things he said is that kids on average actually spend something like 8-9 hours in front of a screen every day. And some of that time, and even some of the time adults spend in front of a screen, are new kinds of stories. They're sort of consuming new stuff. So like World of Warcraft, for example, which is a video game, but in much the same way that a fiction book is, it's a sort of immersive world that you put yourself in.
Exactly. Yeah, I think, again, there's this fear that the novel is dying. And this has been something that people have worried about for at least 100 years. They've been saying that the novel is on its last legs. It's really not. It's doing quite well. But there are new forms of storytelling emerging. But I don't see them as breaks with the past, just as continuations, as evolution. And so if you watch a video game ad on TV, you'll notice that you're watching a movie trailer. It's for an action film. What the game does is puts you in the story. You don't have to watch it from the outside. You get to be that rock-jawed hero of the action film. And right now, you know, the games are pretty simplistic. They tend to be action films, but there's nothing stopping game developers from developing, you know, Desperate Housewives-style games to appeal to different demographics. And when people play the World of Warcraft, these role-playing games online, they describe it as a story. They say it's like being inside a story as it's being written. It's like being a character in a story, but also one of the authors. You get to interact with the story. You get to have a role in how the story ends, and that's really appealing.
And whether it's a novel or whether it's video games, that becomes a sort of permissive way for adults to enter into that kind of golden age of fantasy land that you said maybe characterizes six-year-olds a lot better.
Absolutely. I was talking to one of my friends at a party last weekend, and you know, he's talking without any embarrassment about his journeys and his adventures in the World of Warcraft. And all this is grown-up men making believe. So kind of you're seeing an evolution in story as we move into interactive fiction and video games. We're also seeing a devolution. What we're doing is we're going back to Neverland. What these games allow people to do is, without embarrassment, to go online into digital universes and to be Peter Pan, to make believe again, as though they were children.
Do you feel like there was a time, let's say 100 years ago, we go back to the Victorian age, where actually adults were less permitted to enter into those sort of fantasy worlds than they are now? In fact, Peter Pan is sort of a story of the Victorian age, and the whole idea is Wendy has got to move out of the nursery. You just can't stick with these old stories if you want to be a real adult like her parents.
I guess I'm kind of skeptical that there was ever a time like that. I think people have always wanted stories. I think they've always been hungry for stories to tell them, to consume them. What's different today is there's just an incredible profusion of different ways to wedge more story into our lives at all times. So I carry around this little iPod with me, and on it is crammed a bunch of songs, which are mainly stories, and especially hours and hours and hours, whole libraries worth of audiobooks that I wedge into my life in new ways. So when I'm doing the dishes, I'm reading a story, and it's wonderful. When I'm driving my car, I'm consuming stories. So technology has allowed us to cram more story into our lives than we could before. But that impulse, that hunger, that sort of greed for story that humans have has always been with us.
Since you talk about your iPod and the songs on it, I'm going to play you a little clip from a song that actually factors into your book, and you can tell us how. This is a little bit of Stealing Cinderella by country singer Chuck Wicks.
Dancing with him, Dad, looking up at him. In her eyes, I'm Prince Charming, but to him, I'm just some fella riding in Stealing Cinderella.
So, Jonathan Gottschall, author of The Storytelling Animal, talk about how this factors in, this actual song factors into the book.
Excuse me, I'm weeping. This is sort of the, weirdly enough, it was sort of the inspiration for the book. So a few years ago, I was driving down the road, and it was like a really nice day, and I was in a good mood, and I was spinning the FM dial, and this country music song comes on the radio, and my normal response to this kind of catastrophe is to start smacking at the radio to make the noise stop. But for some reason, I was in a pretty good mood, and the song was kind of heartfelt, and so I listened to it, and I never heard it before. And the song was Chuck Wicks's Stealing Cinderella, and it's a song about a little girl growing up to leave her father behind. And so one second, you know, I'm feeling good and singing along with songs on the radio, and the next second, I am having to veer off the road because I'm crying so hard. And I sat there along the side of the road, you know, feeling sheepish and kind of embarrassed and also wondering, wow, this is weird. What has happened to me? How could I have been melted into helplessness by this sort of music that I don't even like? I think a lot of people can relate to that story because we've all had times when a story has snuck up on us and ambushed us like that. And it's kind of weird that when we submit ourselves to fiction, we allow ourselves to be invaded by the teller. And the fiction teller sort of is in our heads and is in control of our emotions and our cognitions and all that stuff. And I wanted to know how that happened. So I wrote the book in part to try to figure out what happened to me that day. And in so doing, try to get a better grip on this weird and witchy power of story in human life.
And the interesting thing is you talk about how we are sucked into stories, into movies. Everybody has had that experience where they're reading a book or they're watching a movie and they forget that they're reading a book or they're sitting in a movie theater in their chair. They're just in the movie. They forget about that there's people around them and that there's popcorn. They just have forgotten about that. And you notice it, especially when you cringe because something terrible happens and you have just completely forgotten that that's an actor and, you know, he probably has ketchup on him. That's not blood. Mm-hmm. But why are we, even against our wills, sucked into stories that way?
Well, I think you're onto something. I mean, there's something really special about story, about what it does to us mentally. And what you're really describing is an altered state of consciousness, where you are like being on drugs, like being in a trance. When you are in a story, your consciousness is altered. So one group of studies is starting to look at this. It's neuroscientists, psychologists looking at brains on fiction. And you mentioned this thing like in a horror movie. Let's say you're sitting in the audience. You know everything's fake. You know that blood is ketchup. You know that there's actually no humans on that screen. It's just flickers of light on the screen. Your conscious mind knows it, but your unconscious brain does not. That's why we jump out of our seat in the horror film. That's why we scream. Even though we know consciously that's profoundly irrational. So when they slide people into these brain scanners and they show them a film, let's say they show them a Clint Eastwood film, what's interesting is that the brain is not acting like a spectator. The brain is acting very much like a participant in the action. So when Clint Eastwood is angry in the scene, the brain of the viewer also looks angry. Not like it's viewing anger so much, but that it is experiencing anger. It is angry. When the scene is sad, the viewer's brain looks sad also. So part of the reason fiction is so powerful, it moves us so profoundly, is that what is happening on the screen or on the page isn't just happening to the characters. It's happening to us as well.
We're talking to Jonathan Gottschall. He teaches English at Washington and Jefferson College, and he's the author of The Storytelling Animal, which asks sort of, is storytelling a biological imperative? And you actually do sort of think about prehistoric people and why in the world we would have evolved this capability to get completely absorbed by stories, how that would help us. Why does it help us?
Well, this is a difficult question, very difficult. People have just started looking into it. I think it's useful before we throw out a theory or two to take a look at your own hand and to say, what is my hand for? This is a biological organ, obviously. What does it do? And it's obviously for like reaching out and grabbing stuff. It's for contrary things. It's for caressing, but it's also for punching. It's for waving around in the air to make points. We use it to communicate. So the hand has been shaped by multiple evolutionary forces to do multiple evolutionary jobs. The hand isn't like a hammer. It's not a single-purpose tool. The hand is a Swiss Army knife. It's a multi-purpose tool. It has a lot of jobs. And I think while we don't know for sure what story's for, I think that the ultimate answer, the ultimate story about story, is going to be just as complicated. It's going to have multiple evolutionary functions. One of the ideas I look into the book is the idea of that fiction may serve as a sort of virtual reality simulator. In the same way that a pilot straps himself or herself into a flight simulator to train up on the problems of flying a plane, without the potential carnage and hellfire of actually getting into a plane, fiction may serve the same purpose, that we go into these fictional simulations to train up on what it might be like to face these big problems in human life, and that we might get better at confronting these problems as a result. So it's a source of very cheap, vicarious, and safe experience.
How far back have we found evidence that people were telling each other stories?
Oh, it's really difficult, you know, because we don't have records that go back very far. And the first stories died on the wind. You know, they were oral stories and they've left no trace. What you can say is that for all human beings on the planet Earth, they tell stories. This goes for Western Europeans and it goes for people living in villages in Africa and the Antarctic. Storytelling is truly universal. And you always find the same types of stories. Stories have a universal sort of grammar, a structure that's invariant across cultures. There's lots of variation in story, but not in this basic structure. And the basic structure is this. It's very simple. It's about characters facing problems and seeking to overcome them. You never find stories that are about people having a good day. Stories are always about people having a bad day. And so it looks like story is extremely ancient. As far back as you can trace in human anthropology or human history or human culture or human literature, you find that the same astonishing things, they had stories and their stories are just like ours.
Now, when you go back and you look at sort of old nursery rhymes, old Grimm's fairy tales, you said they, people never tell stories about having a good day. some of that stuff is pretty graphic for little children, considering it's nursery rhymes. Why do you think that is? Why tell nursery rhymes or fairy tales that end with such gore and blood sometimes?
Well, there's an interesting chicken and egg question about, like, first off, look at children's stories, not stories told to children, but the stories that children make up and act out in their pretend play. And what you find is that most adults have a radical misconception about them. We misremember Neverland as being this sort of sunny, heavenly bunny land where everything is wonderful and sun-kissed. It's not like that at all. Wonderland, Neverland, is much closer to a hell than a heaven. And so the stories that we tell children are similar to that. So the Grimm's tales are extremely and famously gory and awful. I quote the whole text of a story called The Children Played Butcher with Each Other, where everybody in the story, the mom, the dad, all the children, are basically butchered by the end in graphic detail. And it's pretty awful. And so we don't tell stories like that anymore. We've taken those fairy tales and we still tell them to our children, but we scrub them. But look at a tale like Cinderella. In the original versions, you know, the stepsisters got their toes cut off and their eyes pecked out by crows, and it was just awful and gory. We've trimmed all that out. But it's still an awfully disturbing tale. It's just about a girl who loses her loving parents, her protectors, and comes under the power of people who absolutely despise her. It's something much worse and much darker than just the physical mutilation of the early Grimm's version. Stories are about trouble. That's what they are about.
I know you have two young kids. Have you learned that some of their stories are darker than you might have thought before, let's say, you had kids?
Oh, it just amazes me. It amazes me because I would start to eavesdrop. At the time I was writing the book, my daughters were 7 and 4, right in the sweet spot of children's pretend play. And I would sort of sit on the margins of their play and sometimes be invited in, but I was always observing. And so, well, maybe it was about a month ago, I'm out on the back deck and I'm reading something. My little 6-year-old has one of her friends over and they embrace and they immediately teleport into Neverland. They say, let's play. And I say, okay, and what do you want to play? My daughter says, let's pretend our parents are dead. And boom, I'm dead. And eaten by tigers, as it turns out. And my daughter and a little friend are running around the backyard in this sort of tiger-haunted jungle, and there's bad men, and they're fighting and fleeing for their lives and having a wonderful time doing it. So, yeah, I think adults are often quite surprised by the sort of violence and danger in children's play, and especially in little girls' play, which seems from a distance to be about little babies and nice things, magical pink horses and things like this. But even those sorts of stories that they're telling, if you get a little closer, there's trouble going on. The baby's sick. The baby's dying. The baby has his bones broken off. the baby almost drinks some poison orange juice. I'm quoting from some examples from the book. Story is about trouble, and there seems to be a reason for that. It seems to be, in the case of little children, about sort of preparing them for the rigors and trials of adult life. They're practicing. They're building emotional intelligence, social intelligence, and physical intelligence. When my daughter and her friend are playing that game, they're literally running around the yard, running from imaginary predators.
You talk about how this isn't just, of course, characteristic of kids, but that adults, especially when they're sleeping, when they're unconscious, they also sort of play out different scenarios. What if I did this? What's the worst thing that could happen? So we sort of never lose that, although we might not do it as much during our waking hours. What do dreams do for us, and what kinds of dreams do people have in order to sort of augment their conscious experience?
This was one of the areas that was most interesting to me in my research for the book. So sleep is really a fascinating subject scientifically, and dreams are even more so. So at night, you go to sleep. Your body takes its rest. But our minds are so addicted to story that instead of shutting off for the night and letting the brain get some rest, the mind stays up all night telling itself stories. And these are clearly stories. A conventional definition of a dream is a, quote, vivid sensory motor hallucination within a narrative context. It's a night story. It focuses on a protagonist, usually it's you, trying to overcome obstacles to achieve some desire. And interestingly enough, we don't stop dreaming when the sun comes up. We daydream all day long. Daydreaming is the sort of default
state of human consciousness. So it's hard to study it scientifically. But these little stories that we tell ourselves all through the day take up about half of the day. We spend about 8 hours of the day daydreaming. And sometimes these daydreams are really mundane. You know, I daydreamed before coming to the studio today about the best route into Pittsburgh. Other times, though, they're extremely vivid, very story-like. They're these little fantasies where our most deepest desires, vain, smutty, aggressive, come true, or where our worst nightmares are realized.
Yeah, or where we think about the fears that we have, and people often have these dreams, right, where they're fearful, and the same dream recurs. And in fact, people have spent hundreds of years trying to figure out what it means. You talk a lot about Freud in the book, what it means that we explore alternative realities in dreams.
Yeah, so this is this argument goes back thousands of years. You know, people have been wondering about why we dream. It's profoundly mysterious. Scientists have wondered about it. Shamans have wondered about it. Psychologists have wondered about it, and so forth. The idea that I pay quite a lot of attention to in the book is this idea that dreams are also problem-based, or also trouble-based. We say, oh, if only dreams came true, but, you know, thank God they don't. Dreams are pretty awful. Dreamland is pretty awful. We wouldn't want to live there. And so some dream psychologists have been exploring a similar idea to the sort of flight simulator idea of fiction's purpose, that maybe the reason dreams are so troubled, so problem-saturated, is because they're a sort of, again, a virtual reality program where the mind is going through very intense, very realistic simulations of problems that might someday be faced in waking life, and that by practicing in the dream world, we might actually improve in performance in the waking world.
One of the things that your book made me think about, and that you talk about a bit, is that we look for stories everywhere. You know, sometimes not even places where they are. So I think of the Virgin Mary in a grilled cheese, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, or we connect together words or sentences that may not have anything to do with each other, but our minds want to connect them in some sort of story or tale. You have a bunch of unrelated phrases in your book, and you know, people sort of end up connecting them. Why do we do that? Why do we look for the Virgin Mary and a grilled cheese? Or I think you have a picture of, maybe is it the man on the moon, like a little bit of a, just a rock formation, but looks like a person.
Yeah, yeah. So we have a mind, you know, in the same way that our minds are over-tuned to detect faces, our minds are also over-tuned to detect stories. So we all have this set of left brain neural circuits that have a very important job to do. And their job is to sift through this river of information that's constantly just pouring into the brain and sift it for story patterns, for patterns of cause and effect. And it's a crucial evolutionary adaptation. Without this set of brain circuits, we would experience our lives as a buzzing, blooming confusion. Nothing would make sense or just be chaos or be sound and fury and no order. The downside of these circuits is that they are allergic to uncertainty. They're allergic to randomness. And if they can't find a story out in the world, they're only too happy to invent one. So you talked about some pretty innocuous examples that we talk about in the book. For instance, I array, three sentences, and it's a sort of replication of a psychology experiment that shows that people have a very limited ability not to try to take those three unrelated sentences and turn them into a story. We just do it naturally. Other examples would be bad things like conspiracy theories, where people connect together a bunch of unrelated dots that consist of real data points and fake data points, and they arrange them into a very satisfying narrative about the world that probably just isn't true. So conspiracy theory is sort of a fiction story, and a very powerful fiction story that the conspiracy theorist happens to believe in. And it's one of these examples of how our storytelling minds can run amok and be kind of destructive at times.
Is there any evidence that any other animals besides humans tell stories or crave stories in the way that we do?
Well, I sometimes think about my dog. His name is Sam, and he often runs around the house mauling his stuffed animals. And he has these really incredible running battles with them. And, you know, in real life, he's a coward and a weakling, my dog. But when he's fighting his stuffed animals, I really feel like he's having a fantasy in his head where he's the hero of some doggy epic. You know, he's like Buck in The Call of the Wild. But I'm kind of kidding. You kind of have to have a fairly loose and baggy definition of story, I think, to fit animals within it. There may be animals that have sort of precursors. Like my dog does make believe. You know, he play fights with me. He does pretend. But I think we have to make the definition of storytelling so broad that it's not very useful anymore if we're going to fit animals into it.
I wonder if after writing this book, you start to see stories in everything around you. I was actually, as I finished the book, I pulled up a commercial, and we're going to listen to it. This is for Jameson Irish Whiskey. And I think the interesting thing about this commercial, it's from 2009, is how much they're trying to sell you a product, but the product is really the story. Let's listen.
During the great storm of 1781, John Jameson lost a barrel of his beloved whiskey. He said goodbye to the crew and went in after it. In hindsight, that probably wasn't a good idea. Weeks later, a funeral was held. All of Ireland was in attendance, including John Jameson.
Jonathan Gottschall, do you find yourself now seeing stories in marketing and all sorts of places you didn't see them before?
Yeah, I'm more tuned into it. And I love that commercial, by the way. And part of the reason I'm seeing them everywhere is because they are everywhere. The ad that I pay some attention to in the book is the Jack Link's Beef Jerky ads. There's an ad campaign called Messin' with Sasquatch. And it's about these sort of beef jerky loving kind of immature guys who decide to tease an innocent Sasquatch and earn a violent comeuppance for it. Now, what's interesting about these ads is they're very funny, they're very cool, but they say nothing about the product. Beef jerky is there in the ad only as product placement. It's there in the background, in the same way like a can of Coke might be in the background of a sitcom.
Right.
But it's an extremely useful and powerful ad that really shot Jack Link's to the top. And the reason was they just told a great story. And people loved the stories they told and shared them on their social networks and went out of their way to watch them millions of times on YouTube. So marketers have known this for a long time, that if you want to sell your product, the best way to do it is to work it into a story. And that's sort of what most commercials are. They're 30-second short stories. Not as blatantly as the Jameson's ad and the Bigfoot ad, but still a form of storytelling.
And in this political season, I think people will see it in those 30-second ads, too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think there's a sense that, a political campaign is certainly a contest between these two guys a presidential campaign, the two candidates and their big ideas and their big personality. But it's also a story war. It's about who can shape the more compelling story about the past and the present and the future of the nation.
Right. And you think about The Man from Hope, all these stories, Morning in America, that have been told in the past. I'm Kara Miller, and we've been talking about our human need to tell stories, to hear stories, and to process our own experience through stories. And I've been speaking with Jonathan Gottschall. He teaches English at Washington and Jefferson College, and he is the author of The Storytelling Animal. Jonathan Gottschall, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, so great to be on your show. Thank you.
When we return, we talk about how cell phones are reshaping the world, from healthcare to education to commerce. Unexpected consequences from a ubiquitous invention. Remember that you can listen to our show anytime, anywhere, by subscribing to our free podcasts at wgbh.org/innovationhub. And I want to let our Boston area listeners know that I will be hosting a live Innovation Hub Forum at the Modern Theater at Suffolk University this Thursday, September 27th. We're going to be talking about how automation and robotics are altering the economy. In fact, one of our panelists, Rodney Brooks, was featured in the New York Times this week for creating a surprisingly inexpensive and human-like robot. But another panelist, MIT's Andrew McAfee, argues that increasingly sophisticated robots may be changing the workplace, widening the gap between rich and poor. And we'll learn about the surprising ways that they're replacing humans.
And one of the weirdest phenomena that we're observing these days is some incredibly highly educated professions being deeply affected by automation. And as an example there, one of the ones we talk about in the book is the profession of law, which has historically been a very well compensated, very highly educated one. And now we have things like e-discovery software, which are doing a pretty good job of replacing that room full of lawyers who used to sit around and read boxes of documents as part of a legal process.
Join me for a fascinating discussion about how robots will alter our lives and the economy. That's this Thursday, September 27th at the Modern Theater in Boston. I hope to see you there. To get tickets and more details, go to wgbh.org/innovationhub. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub. Arigato, Mr. Roboto. Mata arrivederci.